Unlike private care, where the difficult, mistaken, or even bad decisions or policies of a single insurance company, hospital, or doctor are usually limited in their societal impact, such governmental decisions and policies have a wide effect on the healthcare industry, medical profession, and population of patients. Moreover, the continued centralization of healthcare decision-making ensures further rationing by government fiat, with fewer avenues of escape by needy individuals who are denied critical health services. For example, because Medicare and Medicaid, along with other government-run health programs, make the federal government the biggest single purchaser of medicines and medical services, it has an enormous influence on the drugs, medical devices, therapies, and treatment modalities that are available to Americans. It achieves this through formularies, the lists of approved drugs that these programs will pay for. Therefore, those which the government will not approve for payment will generally either not make it to the market or not stay on the market for long, significantly influencing the direction of research and development. The government's payment schemes also affect the nature and quality of doctor and hospital care throughout the marketplace. The statist argues that millions of people benefit from these government-run insurance programs. Trillions of dollars in government expenditures over the years should result in benefits, particularly for those who receive far more in return than they contributed to the system. However, tens of millions more people benefit from private health care coverage and receive the best medical attention on the face of the earth. Even the government-run programs benefit from the medical advances the private sector is still able to produce. Without those advances, the government would have little to ration. And the private sector does not forcibly impoverish future generations with a colossal debt incurred on behalf of current beneficiaries. Moreover, millions of people might benefit more if they were not forced to participate in government-run pension and insurance programs. Perhaps they could find less expensive alternatives, invest the taxes deducted from their income to improve their overall financial situation, help pay for food and other necessities during economic setbacks, and hire more employees, who in turn can purchase private insurance, or reinvest the dollars into expanding the business. Most individuals know best how to use their own money, which they earned from their own labor, and most individuals are not self-destructive. Edmund Burke said it well. What is the use of discussing a man's abstract right to food or to medicine? The question is upon the method of procuring and administering them. In that deliberation, I shall always advise to call in the aid of the farmer and the physician, rather than the professor of metaphysics. But it is the statist's purpose to make as many individuals as possible dependent on the government. Most Americans are in fact satisfied with what they pay for their own health care, the quality of the health care they receive, and their health care coverage. However, the statist continues to press for government control over the entire health care system. He is not satisfied with constraining liberty today. He seeks to reach into posterity to constrain liberty tomorrow. President Barack Obama's first choice for health care czar and Secretary of Health and Human Services was Tom Daschle, who was forced to withdraw his name from nomination due to failure to pay federal income taxes. Nonetheless, Daschle laid out the prototype for nationalizing America's health care system in his book, Critical: What We Can Do About the Health Care Crisis. He proposes the establishment of a federal health board, which would make health care recommendations binding on all federal health programs. However, as columnist Tony Blankley points out, Daschle writes that Congress could opt to go further with the board's recommendations. It could, for example, link the tax exclusion for health insurance to insurance that complies with the board's recommendation. That would effectively destroy private health care. Daschle proposes that the board be independent from political pressure, that is, from public input. Daschle also denigrates technological advances as a technology arms race, rather than lauding their benefits to patients. And Daschle laments doctors using their best judgment in providing treatment. No more bothersome insurance regulations, doctor referrals, or copays. Daschle's Medical Politburo is truly a nightmare circa East Germany 1957. A few well-placed political appointees and their bureaucratic support staff ration healthcare resources and decide who gets treatment and who does not, and ultimately, who lives and who dies. For the statist, this is the ultimate authority over the individual he has long craved. Once the individual is entrapped, the statist controls his fate. The individual will be seduced by the notion that he is receiving a benefit from the state, when in reality, the government is merely rationing benefits. The individual is tethered to the state, literally, and utterly reliant on it for his health and survival. Not only does the government have an ownership interest in private property, but it also has one in the physical individual. Rather than the individual making cost-benefit and cost-quality decisions about his own condition, the statist will do it for him. And the statist will do it very poorly, as he does most other things. Chapter 8. On Envirostatism. Science, broadly defined, is a door to knowledge. Although the statist is fond of accusing the conservative of slamming the door shut, it is actually the statist who abandons science, just as he abandons the laws of nature, reason, experience, economics, and modernity, when he promotes what can best be characterized as envirostatism. His pursuit, after all, is power, not truth. With the assistance of a pliant or sympathetic media, the statist uses junk science, misrepresentations, and fear-mongering to promote public health and environmental scares, because he realizes that in a true widespread health emergency, the public expects the government to act aggressively to address the crisis, despite traditional limitations on governmental authority. The more dire the threat, the more liberty people are usually willing to surrender. This scenario is tailor-made for the statist. The government's authority becomes part of the societal frame of reference, only to be built upon during the next crisis. The pathology of the statist health scare works like this. An event occurs. Cases of food contamination are discovered, or instances of a new disease arise. Or, as is increasingly the case, government agencies, such as the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, or the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, or nonprofit organizations, such as the Center for Science in the Public Interest, or Sierra Club, release a new study identifying a frightening new health risk. Urgent predictions are made by cherry-picked experts that the media accept without skepticism or independent investigation, and turn into a cacophony of fear. Public officials next clamor to demonstrate that they are taking steps to ameliorate the dangers. New laws are enacted, or regulations promulgated that are said to limit the public's exposure to the new risk. The examples of this pathology are numerous, and include such scares as ALAR, sweeteners, bird flu, swine flu, dioxins, E. coli, listeria, the Ebola virus, formaldehyde, MTBE, methyl tertiary butyl ether, BSE, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, salmonella attached to tomatoes, jalapeno peppers, and CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons. All were blown into huge panics, far beyond the actual scope of any health threat. Economist George Reisman relates how advances in science make it possible to detect minute levels of contaminants in substances, which are misused in too many cases to destroy products. The presence of parts per billion of a toxic substance is routinely extrapolated into being regarded as a cause of human deaths, and whenever the number of projected deaths exceeds 1 in a million or less, environmentalists demand that the government remove the offending pesticide, preservative, or other alleged bearer of toxic pollution from the market. They do so, even though a level of risk of 1 in a million is 1/3 as great as that of an airplane falling from the sky on one's home. Indeed, the modern environmental movement was founded on one of the most egregious frauds in human history, that dichlorodiphenyltrichloroethane, or DDT, is a human-killing poison, when, in fact, it is a human-saving wonder chemical, a chemical compound developed in 1939 for use as an insecticide. DDT was critical in protecting American soldiers from the typhus epidemic and malaria during World War II. In 1948, Paul Herman Muller received the Nobel Prize for his discovery of the high efficiency of DDT as a contact poison against several arthropods. DDT's usefulness in combating malaria and other insect-borne diseases was unprecedented. San Jose State University professor J. Gordon Edwards, who was a longtime opponent of banning DDT, wrote in 2004, "Hundreds of millions have died from malaria, yellow fever, typhus, dengue, plague, encephalitis, leishmaniasis, filariasis, and many other diseases. In the 14th century, the bubonic plague, transmitted by fleas, killed 1/4 of the people of Europe and 2/3 of those in the British Isles. Yellow fever killed millions before it was found to be transmitted by Aedes mosquitoes. More than 100 epidemics of typhus ravaged civilizations in Europe and Asia, with mortality rates as high as 70%. But by far the greatest killer has been malaria, transmitted by Anopheles mosquitoes. In 1945, the goal of eradicating this scourge appeared to be achievable thanks to DDT. By 1959, the U.S., Europe, portions of the Soviet Union, Chile, and several Caribbean islands were nearly malaria-free. Journalist and best-selling author Malcolm Gladwell recounted the successful eradication campaigns waged in Italy, Taiwan, the Caribbean, the Balkans, parts of Northern Africa, the South Pacific, Australia, and India. In India, where malaria infected an estimated 75 million and killed 800,000 every year, fatalities had dropped to zero by the early 60s. Between 1945 and 1965, DDT saved millions, even tens of millions, of lives around the world, perhaps more than any other man-made drug or chemical before or since. A few years ago, New York Times editorial page writer Tina Rosenberg explained that, "Today, Westerners with no memory of malaria often assume it has always been only a tropical disease. But malaria was once found as north as Boston and Montreal. Oliver Cromwell died of malaria, and Shakespeare alludes to it as ague in 8 plays. Malaria no longer afflicts the United States, Canada, and Northern Europe, in part because of changes in living habits, the shift to cities, better sanitation, window screens. But another reason was DDT, sprayed from airplanes over American cities and towns, while children played outside." So effective is DDT that in 1970, the National Academy of Sciences announced that "to only a few chemicals does man owe as great a debt as to DDT. In little more than 2 decades, DDT has prevented 500 million human deaths due to malaria that would have otherwise been inevitable." But in 1962, Rachel Carson, an opponent of pesticides, succeeded in spreading widespread hysteria about DDT's effects on wildlife, and especially children. In her book, Silent Spring, Carson decried the broad use of DDT. As Reason science correspondent Ron Bailey wrote, "Carson was an effective popularizer of the idea that children were especially vulnerable to the carcinogenic effects of synthetic chemicals. The situation with respect to children is even more deeply disturbing," she wrote. "A 1/4 century ago, cancer in children was considered a medical rarity. Today, more American school children die of cancer than from any other disease." In support of this claim, Carson reported that 12% of all deaths in children between the ages of 1 and 14 are caused by cancer. Although it sounds alarming, Carson's statistic is essentially meaningless unless it's given some context, which she failed to supply. It turns out that the percentage of children dying of cancer was rising because other causes of death, such as infectious diseases, were drastically declining. It is a sickening irony that Carson's focus on children helped kill the use of DDT, when malaria is the cause of death of millions of children living in undeveloped countries. In fact, nowhere in Silent Spring did Carson mention that DDT had saved tens of millions of lives, a widely known fact by 1962, but of no apparent import to her or her growing legion of adherents. The media gobbled up Carson's alarmism. President John Kennedy formed an advisory committee to investigate her claims. Congress held hearings. The Environmental Defense Fund and the Sierra Club brought litigation to pressure the government to ban DDT. Although DDT has never been directly linked to even one human death, Gladwell recounts incidents of test subjects literally lathering themselves with DDT. The EPA, which had been established in 1970, banned DDT in 1972. Its use worldwide soon plummeted because the United States and the United Nations World Health Organization would no longer provide financial support for the life-saving chemical's use. But even the manner in which the EPA banned DDT was an abuse of both the scientific and legal process. An EPA administrative law judge held several months of hearings on DDT's environmental and health risks. In the end, Judge Edmund Sweeney found that DDT is not a carcinogenic hazard to man. DDT is not a mutagenic or teratogenic hazard to man. The use of DDT under the regulations involved here do not have a deleterious effect on freshwater fish, estuarine organisms, wild birds, or other wildlife. However, Sweeney's ruling was rejected by EPA Administrator William Doyle Ruckelshaus, who in 1972 banned it anyway. Ruckelshaus attended none of the hearings, and aides reported he had not read the hearing transcript before overruling Sweeney's findings. At the time, Ruckelshaus belonged to the Audubon Society, and later joined the Environmental Defense Fund, which, along with the Sierra Club, was a budding organization that brought lawsuits pressing for DDT's ban. Only recently has the world community begun to revisit the benefits of DDT. In 2006, the World Health Organization announced that it would reverse years of policy and back the use of DDT as a way to control malaria outbreaks. Better late than never. But the ban's human cost has been enormous. In 2002, the American Council on Science and Health reported that 300 million to 500 million people suffer from malaria each year, 90% occurring in Africa. It is the number one killer of children there. Overall, the ban has resulted in the deaths of millions. The EPA and its environmental group masters conspired in a deliberate and systematic distortion of science, leading to genocide-like numbers of deaths of human beings throughout the undeveloped world. Today, the Environmental Defense Fund and the Sierra Club, and scores of similar groups, raise tens of millions of dollars a year to promote their causes in Congress, the bureaucracy, and the courts, are relied on frequently by the media for expert comment, and make no apologies for the consequences of their success in banning DDT. Ruckelshaus, a Republican, rose through the executive branch and has received acclaim for his public service. He currently serves on the boards of numerous corporations and endorsed Barack Obama for president. After her death in 1964, Carson was the recipient of numerous honors and awards. Her childhood home is on the National Register of Historic Places, and the home she lived in when she wrote Silent Spring was named a National Historic Landmark. There are no landmarks or memorials for those who suffered and perished from the banning of DDT. In the name of protecting wildlife and children, millions of human lives were needlessly sacrificed. On its website, the group Earth First declares that it does not accept a human-centered worldview of nature for people's sake. It insists that life exists for its own sake, that industrialized civilization and its philosophy are anti-Earth, anti-woman, and anti-liberty. To put it simply, the Earth must come first. Is not man therefore expendable? And if he is not the suppression of his liberty, the confiscation of his property, and the blunting of his progress at all times warranted where the purpose is to save the planet, or any part of it, from man himself? After all, it would seem that there can be no end to man's offenses against nature if he is not checked at every turn. National Park Service ecologist David M. Graber, writing in the Los Angeles Times in 1989, well articulated the perversity of this view. We contaminated the planet with atmospheric hydrocarbons and metals beginning in the Industrial Revolution. The Atomic Age wrote another indelible signature in radioisotopes on every bit of the Earth's surface. DDT and its kin appear even in the Antarctic ice. I, for one, cannot wish upon either my children or the rest of Earth's biota a tame planet, a human-managed planet, be it monstrous or, however unlikely, benign. I am not interested in the utility of a particular species, or free-flowing river, or ecosystem to mankind. They have intrinsic value, more value to me, than another human body, or a billion of them. Human happiness, and certainly human fecundity, are not as important as a wild and healthy planet. I know social scientists who remind me that people are part of nature, but it isn't true. Somewhere along the line, at about a billion years ago, maybe half that, we quit the contract and became a cancer. We have become a plague upon ourselves and upon the Earth. It is cosmically unlikely that the developed world will choose to end its orgy of fossil energy consumption, and the third world its suicidal consumption of landscape. Until such time as Homo sapiens should decide to rejoin nature, some of us can only hope for the right virus to come along. If nature has intrinsic value, then nature exists for its own sake. Consequently, man is not to be preferred over any aspect of his natural surroundings. He is no better than any other organism, and much worse than most, because of his destructive existence. And so it is that the Envirostatus abandons reason for a faith that preaches human regression and self-loathing. He does so by claiming the moral high ground, saving man from himself and nature from man. Most individuals who are sympathetic to environmental causes are unwitting marks, responsive to the Envirostatist's manipulation of science, imagery, and language. Over time, they self-surrender liberty for authority, abundance for scarcity, and optimism for pessimism. Save the planet is the rallying cry that justifies nearly any intrusion by government into the life of the individual. The individual, after all, is expendable. Who would have thought that the flush toilet would become controversial? It is not only an everyday convenience, which would be enough, but critical to human health. No matter. In 1992, Congress passed the Energy Policy and Conservation Act, outlawing the 3.5-gallon toilet and replacing it with the 1.6-gallon toilet. The purpose was to reduce the use of water. To this day, the mandated change requires users to flush the toilet more often, which hardly saves water. A government that is powerful enough to dictate the flow of water in a toilet is a very powerful government indeed. Some Envirostatists even advocate for dry toilets, which are basically dirt pits, especially for the undeveloped world. They claim flush toilets would be an environmental disaster if China and the Third World used more of them. Clearly, the world's poor are among the Envirostatists' most victimized populations. Today, almost 1.6 billion people use candles and kerosene lamps to light their homes, filling them with smoke and soot and risking fire. In India, where 600 million people live without electricity, Greenpeace campaigned against the incandescent light bulb because it emits carbon dioxide, apparently forgetting the polluting effect of burning kerosene for light. The light bulb, they said, is a hazardous product to everyone, and they dubbed Philips Electronics, India's major light bulb producer, a climate criminal. In much of the world where the statist reigns, the nights remain dark. In 2002, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld commented that, "If you look at a picture from the sky of the Korean Peninsula at night, South Korea is filled with lights and energy and vitality and a booming economy. North Korea is dark." Even in the United States, Congress banned incandescent bulbs by 2014, replacing them with the costlier compact fluorescent light bulbs, which contain highly toxic mercury. Those without power in India and parts of Asia also suffer through sweltering heat, routinely over 100 degrees. In 2007, the New York Times wrung its hands because the world's atmospheric scientists are concerned that the air condition boom sweeping across Asia could lead to more serious problems with the ozone layer. The washing machine, which liberated mostly women from the arduous task of hand-washing clothes, is attacked for its consumption of energy and water and use with laundry detergent. Lawnmowers, chainsaws, leaf blowers, and barbecue grills are all environmental targets. But the technology most despised by the enviro-statist is the automobile, because it provides the individual with a tangible means to exercise his independence through mobility. Starting with the Arab oil embargo of 1973, in which the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries cut oil exports to the United States for supporting Israel in the Yom Kippur War, the automobile has been relentlessly demonized as the enemy of the environment. Among the government's responses to the embargo was the imposition of corporate average fuel economy, or CAFE standards, on automobiles in 1975. Its proponents argued that more efficient cars would cut gasoline use, thereby reducing reliance on foreign oil and pollution. But this position was always counterintuitive. More efficient cars reduce the per-mile cost of driving, enabling consumers to pay less than they otherwise would for driving more. In fact, the CAFE standards have not reduced America's importation of oil. In 1970, the United States imported about 20% of its oil, compared with over 60% today. And while better fuel economy produces more emissions resulting from more driving, CAFE standards were never going to make a significant impact on greenhouse gas emissions. The Heritage Foundation's Charlie E. Kuhn has noted that cars and light trucks subject to fuel economy standards make up only 1.5% of all global man-made greenhouse gas emissions. Although CAFE standards have failed to reduce gasoline consumption or significantly improve the environment, they have succeeded in killing tens of thousands of human beings. The reason? The laws of physics. In order to meet the per-gallon fuel efficiency standards set by Congress, the automobile industry has been forced to reduce the size and weight, mass, of vehicles. Consequently, automobiles and light trucks contain more plastic and aluminum than ever before. Their human occupants are more vulnerable to injury and death from most kinds of accidents. The evidence proves the point. In 1989, analysts at the Brookings Institution and Harvard University estimated that 2,000 to 3,900 lives are lost and 20,000 serious injuries occur each year in traffic accidents resulting from smaller, lighter cars. The Competitive Enterprise Institute examined 1997 traffic fatality data and concluded that CAFE standards caused between 2,600 and 4,500 deaths in 1997. In 1999, USA Today analyzed the statistical link between CAFE standards and traffic fatalities and reported that 46,000 people have died in crashes they would have survived in bigger, heavier cars since 1975. In 2001, a National Academy of Sciences panel reported that the downweighting and downsizing of light vehicles in the 1970s and early 1980s, partly due to CAFE standards, probably resulted in an additional 1,300 to 2,600 traffic fatalities in 1993.